Hello and welcome to Conversations in Lung Cancer Research, a TOGA podcast where we discuss the latest breakthroughs in lung cancer research and treatment in Australia and New Zealand. My name is Professor Tom John. I'm a medical oncologist at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne. I am broadcasting today from Victoria in Melbourne on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And I pay my respect to their elders past, present and emerging. We also extend that respect to all Indigenous people. In today's episode, we're exploring cancer vaccines and their emerging role in lung cancer treatment. And there's been a lot of excitement around this recently, with renewed interest in vaccines across multiple cancer types following technological developments that have allowed for the rapid rollout of COVID-19 vaccines and recent lung cancer vaccine trials, which were announced last year in the UK. And there have also been trials in other cancer types. So today on the show, I'm really excited to have two amazing guests. The first is probably well known to the lung cancer community in Australia. This is Professor Ken O'Byrne. Ken is a medical oncologist and clinical scientist at the Princess Alexandra Hospital and Queensland University of Technology. He's currently the PI of the Interpath 009V940 personalized neoantigen mRNA vaccine trial in early stage non-small cell lung cancer. And you may have noticed my second guest is the 2024 Australian of the Year, Professor Georgina Long. And you might be asking, well, why do we have Professor Georgina Long, who is the medical director of the Melanoma Institute of Australia and the chair of the Melanoma Medical Oncology and Translational Research at MIA, the University of Sydney and the Mater and Royal North Shore Hospitals. Georgina is well known to the oncology community as an expert and PI of multiple melanoma studies. And you might be asking, well, why are we involving a melanoma expert in a lung cancer podcast? Well, there's actually quite a lot of overlap. And as it turns out, both lung cancer and melanomas are very sensitive to immunotherapy. And we feel that there may well be overlap in terms of the development of vaccine strategies. And in fact, Georgina has led the Interpath 001 trial, which also looks at V940 personalized neoantigen vaccines in combination with pembrolizumab, which was previously involved in the KEYNOTE 942 study, which was published in 2024, a phase two trial looking at the V940 vaccine. It's a pleasure to welcome you both to TOGA's Conversation in Lung Cancer Research podcast. I thought it would be good to really start by looking at where we've come from. And Ken has been around for a while in the lung cancer space and has seen vaccines come and go over the last 20, 30 years. Why do you think, Ken, that there is all this excitement now compared to previous excitement for lung cancer vaccines? Is something different? Where have we come from? Have vaccines had promise before that failed? What's been your experience?
Well, I suppose the first thing to mention has been the positive data from the melanoma study, because up until that trial, we had really no positive data to go on that we were going to achieve anything with it, with vaccines. And I just want to do a little bit of history to go back to Ian Fraser. I think Ian Fraser, you know, from here at the University of Queensland, who pioneered the HPV vaccine that has really proven to be preventative of, you know, HPV cancers, really deserves a special mention, because that was recognized as one of the top five advances in medicine or in oncology by ASCO back, I think, in 2005. So that's kind of, you know, that's the starting point. But since then, we haven't really had a big hit. And then, of course, it was a melanoma trial, which was positive. I think, Georgina, you were involved in that trial.
The mRNA vaccine, absolutely. Yeah. I was involved, the phase two randomized.
Exactly. I mean, that's really created the new kind of interest in vaccines. I think also the fact that the immune checkpoint inhibitors have been so positive in terms of treatment of lung and melanoma, gave us a starting point to actually say, well, look, if we give a vaccine after we activate the immune system, could we actually enhance the immune effects of the checkpoint inhibitors against the cancers? I think that was a massive advance. It's like all these things. Somebody, a famous Nobel Prize winner in medicine in Australia, once I was asked, how did you manage to get the Nobel Prize? And he said, because I had the technology to move forward faster than anybody else. And I think, you know, the technology advances that we have now are awesome. And I suppose enhanced by the COVID, you know, crisis, you know, moving forward with the mRNA vaccines and how to optimize giving those has really revolutionized the way we can develop and deliver effective vaccines that can be expressed by the antigen-presenting cells and activate the immune system against the cancers. That's been a massive step forward. So technology has led the way. And as somebody who was involved in many, many early immune therapy trials with COX inhibitors and various other things to try and boost the immune response and getting beautifully negative results every time, it's really nice now to be in the era where we really are making an impact.
Yeah, so I'm sure Georgina has been part of many of these failed vaccine strategies as well. One of the big ones in lung cancer, you know, there was a big trial called MAGRIT, which, you know, looked at vaccinating against a cancer testis antigen called MAGE. And, you know, the phase two study was positive for progression-free survival. And we'll hear a bit more about that in the melanoma context with Georgina. But the phase three was negative. It was the biggest phase three trial that was conducted in lung cancer as a, you know, one of the first sort of immunotherapy trials. But a similar experience has been seen in melanoma, and this time there seems to be a lot more excitement, though. We have seen phase two trials that have been positive previously that the phase three has failed for. Georgina, you were involved in the phase two V940 study. Do you think this is different to other vaccine trials?
I mean, looking at the whole history, as Ken nicely summarised, I do think this is different. But it's not, I mean, the mRNA technology is absolutely one of those key massive steps forward in medicine. One of the greatest advantages is the technology in terms of its efficiency. So very quickly, you can actually make a vaccine using the mRNA technology. And vaccination and the types of vaccines that we're using, and now we're talking about treatment. I think this is really important. We're talking about treatment vaccines. So patients with active cancer, whether it be micrometastatic disease in the adjuvant setting or, you know, metastases that we can see and measure, these are both treatment vaccines. Has evolved so much. And it's not just that improvement in the technology, but we've also understood what else we need to do to stimulate the immune system. And that parallel change with checkpoint inhibitors has helped understand more about the immune system as well. So just to give a quick little history from a melanoma point of view, like lung, slogging at it for decades, long before I was on the scene, doing things like autologous vaccines where you mush up a bit of cancer and inject it back into the patient with an adjuvant in that setting, really meaning immunostimulatory, hoping to induce an immune reaction against the tumor. They failed using BCG with an autologous melanoma tumor. That was thought in a phase three, a randomized trial to improve outcomes. But in fact, the arm without the vaccine, what we think was happening there is we were inducing tolerance, meaning that you're not vaccinating in the right way. You're actually making the tumor look like a friend to the immune system so it can flourish. So there's all this evolution in terms of the biology and the understanding. Then there's this concurrent evolution of the technology. And now we land here at mRNA and its ease of production. We've also technologically advanced so that we can identify the genome, both the transcriptome, RNA, and the DNA, to work out what is a neoantigen. And that's a whole nother discussion in itself. So we've got this wonderful coming together of technology and understanding and efficiency so we can get a genome within a few days to do this work and try and leverage the immune system. So it's multiple things together that really mean we are in the time to try and see this work. I do have to say one thing about the melanoma mRNA phase 2 trial. So that's been the first randomized trial in the modern era, to seem positive. And I want to say seem positive because it was phase 2. It was conducted actually during COVID. We started working with Moderna long before COVID. It was 2018. We also started working with BioNTech before COVID. They then pivoted to COVID. And so some of the patients enrolled in this trial, they're not a true randomized population. So I just put that caveat out there. We have fully recruited to the phase 3 trial. Those results will be out in the coming years, but we do have to exercise caution in looking at this signal from a small randomized phase 2. And those results, just to remind people, randomized phase 2, 107 patients in one arm, 50 in another. It was a 2-to-1 randomization to the intervention of pembrolizumab combined with an mRNA personalized vaccine. So we identify the neoantigens in each individual's tumor, melanoma. The hazard ratio for recurrence-free survival was 0.51, and that was significant. But significant one-sided P, and it is a randomized phase 2. So let's just hold caution with that. Let's call that a signal. But we have to wait for the phase 3.
Yeah, thank you. I think it is important that those words, I think, are very critical, that we do have to be cautious, although cautiously optimistic, I think. We've certainly seen this before in lung cancer and in melanoma, where phase 2 trials have unfortunately not ended up translating in the phase 3 context. But this does certainly look a lot better than what we've seen for any other phase. You know, that hazard ratio of 0.5 certainly is much stronger than some of the other studies. And in fact, the MAGRIT trial, which I mentioned for MAGE-A3 in lung cancer, I mean, that was launched off. Actually, the phase 3 was launched off a negative phase 2, but, you know, they actually felt that there was a signal there. It didn't end up translating.
Sorry, just the derma trial, very similar to the lung cancer one. That was the MAGE-A3 adjuvant trial in melanoma.
Yeah.
That was negative as well. Patients were randomized to observation versus a derma or MAGE-A3 vaccine in the adjuvant setting in melanoma, and that was completely negative.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was one lung cancer trial, Stimavax, people remember, the live peg delivery of a vaccine against MUC1. And that was kind of interesting. And you know, to look back at the data, it was for patients at stage 3, as far as I recall, and there were people with concurrent versus sequential chemoradiation. And I think there was a signal in the concurrent, even when they look back at the data. So, you know, you wonder, how do we deliver these things? What's the optimum way to deliver them? So there's lots of stuff to learn, tons of stuff to learn. And if you look at all the trials, and I just actually kept a spreadsheet in front of me, there's different sequences of different vaccines in different ways. And, you know, we will learn how to do this better, I'm sure, over time. I'm certain about that. Same with checkpoint inhibitors.
I mean, it might be a good idea just to dot point those things we have to really focus in on: delivery, you know, what's the nanoparticle, what's immune stimulant, technology, mRNA, peptide, DNA, population, stage 4 with disease on board versus adjuvant and earlier stage. Checkpoint inhibitor combination, what's the best sequence of combination? Really, do we need something at the early stage of the activation, CTLA-4, to really maximize our vaccine? Maybe not for mRNA, maybe for peptide or vice versa. I mean, there are 4 dot points that we have to drill down on in the next decade, which is great. It's great to have this opportunity.
Yeah, I completely agree. And they're really interesting points that you raise again, Georgina. So maybe I'll ask this of you, Ken. Do you feel, because, you know, with neoantigen vaccines, they can be peptides or they can be mRNA. I mean, the technology has evolved for us to be able to develop vaccines fairly quickly. Do you feel there's a difference between peptide versus mRNA vaccines in this space? There are some peptide vaccines going forward still.
Yeah. Look, it's hard to say. It's like you just get a gut feeling. I just think that the delivery of a message to a cell in the form of DNA or in the form of mRNA, it sounds like the best way to do things. You know, it just feels right. You know, when you look at the mRNA is handled, I mean, again, you have the the personalized versus the off-the-shelf versions. BioNTech seems to have gone down, mainly down the road of the off-the-shelf, whereas Moderna and Merck have gone, seem to go off the road of looking at the personalized vaccines. And it just seems to make sense to have the cell produce the protein that's expressed on the cell surface to activate. So it seems in a way more physiological. I mean, that's just my own gut feeling. And the strongest data we seem to have at the present time is in that mode. And I think we will talk about preventative as different from, therapeutic types. But certainly in the therapeutic area, that's just my bias. But again, I'm open to looking and seeing. I think the other thing not to forget as well is that there are very significant advances, I believe, being made in augmenting the effects of immune checkpoint inhibitors. Okay, now I've just got to look to the side to pronounce the name, because I always forget this name. The trial is looking at eftilagimod. I have to look at that because I can never remember it. FT is a short, it's easy to remember that way. So we're involved in the ImmuneTep phase 3 trial. And, you know, here we have a drug that potentially is augmenting MHC class 2 expression, or activity at least. So, you know, that looks like it's potentiating the impact of pembrolizumab in the data that's available. We'll find out in the phase 3 trials. But you can imagine having FT, pembro, and a vaccine together. Now, this gets very interesting. So not only are you delivering, you know, epitopes basically to the tumors, you know, that present the peptide when it's made, but you might be augmenting the ability of those peptides to be presented on the cell surface. It's really kind of very exciting. I just think this is really cool stuff, you know. So we're going to have really exciting times developing these therapies, and we're going to see the positive effects of these in our patients, which is just fantastic. You know, I know, Georgie, you've been involved very much in a personal way in trying to enhance, you know, activity in a patient, a friend. But we, you know, we all have those patients where just to see something magic happen is, it's still in a way magical. To see a patient come in with state, I mean, I remember with nivolumab, we had a lady came in a wheelchair. She had a disease in her scalp, in her lung, in her leg. She was in a wheelchair. She was otherwise pretty fit. So we said, look, we'll give her some nivolumab. She's cured. Like, it's just like magic. She said, within a month, she said, I feel normal again. And so I think we're going to see the same things happen with our patients with these combinations. I'm very confident. So I agree totally. I'm guarded because you have to prove that it works. And I think modern phase 2 trials are possibly a bit better than the old phase 2 trials were. It does stimulate that optimism that we're going to get this sorted out.
Yeah, thanks. I agree. I think there's certainly a lot more to be said for vaccinating, where you don't have to, you know, worry about HLA restrictions, which you do have to with peptides. You know, the mRNA certainly makes things a lot more straightforward from that perspective. And certainly the range of epitopes that you can generate is much larger. Sorry, Georgina, you were going to say something.
Yeah, Tom, I was just going to pick up on the MHC 1 and 2 story just quickly. Yeah. I dot pointed four things that we all agree are areas of growth, and Ken nicely highlighted the MHC 2 story. But one important part, if we delve into identification of neoantigens, so we're talking still, well, I'm talking still about the personalized vaccines, which are tumor-informed, versus the off-the-shelf tumor-informed, which are looking for shared antigens across many people with said cancer A or melanoma or lung cancer. So what I was going to say is all of the platforms that go about trying to identify what personalized neoantigens to use. So you've mentioned one advantage, Tom, and that is the mRNA. We're allowed to quickly include many neoantigens. So, for example, more than 30 for Moderna, more than 20 for BioNTech, but that's a bit arbitrary. You can go right up to 46, but that may impact some of the expression of those neoantigens. But you can put a lot quickly, whereas peptide vaccines, because you're actually making the peptide, it's actually quite heavy and you're loading up this nanoparticle with a lot of material. So you're limited to 10, for example, and sometimes they're hard to synthesize. So you've got to actually synthesize those peptides. So you might identify 10 using your RNA and DNA analyses. So you test the tumor. You then use the platform to identify the neoantigens, and that's where I want to talk about MHC 1 and 2. But then you've got to load these peptides that you've synthesized in. And so that's a barrier, because not all of them can be synthesized and not all of them can be put into a nanoparticle. So they're the drawbacks on a peptide vaccine versus mRNA, where you can quickly use 32 neoantigens. But on the MHC 1 versus 2 story, when we are identifying neoantigens, it's basically a score. So everyone has their different platform to identify neoantigen, but they're actually quite similar. And the three aspects that they're looking for is clonality. So if they find an abnormality in your tumor, let's call it individual A's tumor, is it clonal? That's important. The higher the clonality, the better. Number two, is it being expressed by the RNA? Is it actually being expressed? And number three, then it's MHC1 and 2 binding with this focus on MHC1, but I think we're forgetting the whole CD4-MHC2 story and some of those are neoantigens. So neoantigens that we use both MHC1 and 2 may be the most powerful, etc. But so they're all another layer of questions that we're yet to answer. I identified four big ones, but, you know, what sort of neoantigens do we put into what technology? And is MHC2 as important or more than one, vice versa? And does it differ for different cancers? So something like pancreatic cancer, where you're probably not going to have as many MHC1s, where you're going to have to rely on CD4. Yeah, so these are questions that I think we're still yet to answer. But as soon as you start delving into the depths, you can see how complicated it gets.
Yes, indeed.
And we must measure. We've got to collect blood and we've got to get tissue. So if any of us are going to do trials, we have to build that in so that we understand what we're doing.
Yeah, completely agree.
Just the other thing, just I always have this little bit of caution, is the tolerance issue. You know, there's just a possibility that in certain situations, as you really kind of alluded to indirectly, Georgina, is that it may be that depending on how you activate the immune system, you might actually induce tolerance, not actually anti-tumor effect. You might get initial anti-tumor response and then have tolerance. So there's lots of stuff to learn about. It's a complex path, but I still remain positive. I still think it's exciting. It's a buzz thing to be involved in. It's great.
It is. I wanted to pivot a little bit here and just ask, we're all in agreement that the mRNA platforms are certainly the most exciting thing we've seen in vaccine technology in a long time. Georgina, you've been involved in two of these main platforms, so the BioNTech through the iNeST studies, as well as the Moderna platform. The BioNTech study recently, I think there was a press release saying that this was a study looking at metastatic melanoma. And the press release said there was no difference in patients who received the vaccine. I'm not sure if you can talk us through a little bit of that.
I was not actually involved in that particular BioNTech personalized vaccine study. I have been involved with the off-the-shelf for antigen trial of BNT111. So I don't have the details of those results yet. But big picture, if they're negative, as we do with all oncology trials, the first thing we go down, do we think about is the patient population. How negative was it? Do we see the curve separate? Is there a bit of a signal there? I don't know. I can't answer that for all of us at this point. But as we discussed offline, Tom, the first thing is, is there something about metastatic disease that makes this negative? It needs to be delved into the baseline characteristics, also how many patients had a vaccine made, what were the difference between the two arms, was there some bias in there? Because I do know our phase two for the V940, the personalized vaccine with Moderna, there is a slight bias there. If you look at the tumor mutation burden at baseline in the phase two of V940, the patients on the mRNA plus Pembro arm have a higher tumor mutation burden, right?
Oh.
Yeah. So just slightly, you can see it when you see the box plots. That was presented at AACR 2024 from memory. So there are these slight differences that need to be explored when you get a negative result to learn and understand. It's interesting, despite the higher tumor mutation burden, it's only small. It wasn't statistically significant, but it's obvious when you see the pictures, the box plot together. If you just looked at the group who had a high tumor mutation burden and got Pembro alone versus Pembro plus the personalized vaccine, you can see a splitting of the curves, of the RFS curves. So that's good to see that because that sort of gets rid of that bias. And you see a little bit of a splitting in the low tumor mutation burden as well.
There's a greater benefit in people who have a higher tumor mutational burden, which is sort of counterintuitive, right?
Yeah, that's what it looks like. But you can't tell actually because the curves split nicely in low tumor mutation burden as well. But we're talking small numbers. We're talking 19, 26, 30, 79, You know what I mean? Because there's 2-to-1 randomized. So you can't say, but what I can say is in each of those two subgroups, when you try and get rid of this bias of higher tumor mutation burden in the Pembro plus arm, when you split it by high and look at Pembro versus Pembro plus vaccine and low, you still see a separation of those RFS curves, which makes you feel a bit more confident. You're not seeing everything in one group. So just to highlight that when you're looking at these smallest trials, when it's negative, particularly like this study you mentioned for the BioNTech, we need to delve into all those details of the baseline characteristics, the vaccine, et cetera, and also the longitudinal blood tests, the peripheral T cells, hopefully they collected enough, PBMCs basically, peripheral mononuclear blood cells, to analyze the T cells and what they did with each vaccination. Certainly, I do a lot of peptide vaccines as well as mRNA. And I do want to mention there's a whole heap of mRNA drugs which are not vaccines, but are utilizing the mRNA technology. That's not what we're talking about here. We are specifically talking about vaccines. But remember that mRNA technology is just fantastic technology that's being explored in other ways. But with the peptide vaccines, we do that. We collect longitudinal PBMCs to see what the vaccination is actually doing to the T cells. We also create, because we've made the peptides, we create, and you can do this with the mRNA vaccines as well, we look at the T cells and how if they're specifically responding to the neoantigen that we created. And we see that. So these are all very encouraging things that we're seeing.
Yeah. Can I ask you, how do you feel this is going to translate in lung cancer? So one of the, I actually don't know about this in melanoma at all, but in lung cancer, Georgina, we certainly know there are some mutations particularly that seem to confer immunoresistance. So things such as STK11 and KEAP1. And you've mentioned another thing, TMB, you know, these are all things that we're not really focused on in terms of stratification. So there are going to be heterogeneities in the populations of patients in these studies. Ken, do you think those sorts of things are going to play into the adjuvant V940 study?
Yeah, I mean, I think they may well do, Tom. And again, you know, I think Georgina keeps making the point, I think it's a very important point, that any trial that we do is actually an observational study as well as actually being a test of whether the drug works or not. And I think by doing the trials that we're doing, you know, making sure that we look at the translational biology very carefully, I think that we will identify, if you like, signatures that would be associated with resistance. I have no doubt about that. But we will also identify signatures that are associated with sensitivity. And by taking the tumor and, you know, sequencing the tumor and looking for neoantigens that you feel would be expressed appropriately, and that's pretty well characterized now, reasonably well characterized, I think that we will develop effective vaccines against tumors and in generality, but we will also learn about those tumors that are creating resistance. And it may be simple things like I mentioned earlier, MHC class 1 and 2 expression, you know, those kind of things that we, you know, we're going to learn about those things. And I always get, you know, Tom, you know this well yourself, get pulled back to the EGFR story back in the day when we had an effective drug, but the randomized trials were basically negative. And they were negative because we were treating everybody, but we weren't treating the patients who were going to benefit, which was that 10% of patients with EGFR mutations and obviously more in the Eastern population, but in the Western population. Those trials ended up being negative. And we missed the signals in there that, you know, combination of EGFR TKI with chemo might actually be beneficial in the mutation positive patients. And now that's all moving forward. So I think it's looking at what you do, keeping an open mind, sitting down around the table and getting many, many questions. And I've no doubt in the end that we will come up with a vaccine approaches that would be very individualized to the individual patient. And we're getting there increasingly with precision oncology with TKIs. We're getting there even with checkpoint inhibitors. You know, if you've got PD-L1 over 50%, and then you've got tumor mutation burden, and then you've got maybe, you know, other features as well that you can actually say, well, that person's likely to respond. And then you can, so it's increasingly, if they got CD8 infiltration in their tumor, that person's likely to respond. And so we'll get better at doing that. And the same will apply to vaccines. I'm absolutely certain of that. It's just a matter, it's going to take time to work all of this out. The two phase 3 trials, you know, the 002 and the 009 studies that are coming through, both of those are massive opportunities because you're going to have tumor, particularly in the 002, you're going to have baseline resected tumor. They're going to be gold, absolute gold. I think that's building in the translational programs there are really, really important.
Do you think the BioNTech study, which, you know, the press release was negative for, this is in metastatic disease, you know, the positive V940 study in melanoma, again, a positive study, but in the adjuvant setting. Do you think there's a role for vaccines in the metastatic setting? Is it too much to overcome?
Yeah, I forgot to make that point before when I said the BioNTech, we have to delve into the baseline population, but they were metastatic. You make a good point. Whereas the V940 Moderna personalized vaccine was adjuvant, so mainly stage 3 or resected disease. Look, I'm not sure on that. I've been open-minded about that. I think there are some metastatic patients where we will be able to use vaccines, particularly the nation, but you know, we don't want to be making these expensive vaccines if you don't need it.
Yep.
So if you can get away with checkpoints, go for it, and then add in a vaccine in a certain subpopulation. So that's still a piece to be worked out, Tom, but you make a good point. At one, you know, where are these best used and what are the things that we can't use them in and what do we have to do to overcome that? I want to bring up one related point which may help people thinking about it. The opposite occurred recently with anti-PD-1 combined with anti-LAG-3. So we saw a positive trial of the combo PD-1 LAG-3 versus PD-1 alone in stage 4 melanoma advanced, so metastases. And we've just seen a negative result in the adjuvant setting where you remove the tumor and then give drug. And we do think having the machinery of your lymph nodes and having a certain volume of tumor on board to mount an immune response is important for checkpoint inhibitors. Remembering that PD-1 alone is better than nothing in the adjuvant setting, in that micrometastatic disease setting. So there's still a lot to explore about what you need intact and how much tumor on board to really get a good immune response. And we certainly see great responses with the combo of PD-1 and LAG-3 neoadjuvantly as well. So I think we are at kindergarten with immune therapy being the big field of immunotherapy. Checkpoints have not been optimized in many other cancers. We do not dose them appropriately. We have these chemotherapy approaches, which are absolutely wrong. It's not to be given every 3 weeks or every 4 weeks and you can't miss a dose. No, it's a switch. You switch that switch well. Hang back, hang 10. Don't give the patient toxicity. Just wait, do a scan. Are they responding? Stretch it to 6 weeks. I mean, there's so much more to explore on immunotherapy. It is so fundamentally different to chemotherapy. And that is something the oncology field has not yet grasped. We really are in the 1960s of chemo with immunotherapy. We're right there at the beginning. And this is the true of vaccines. In fact, we're even more. We're like in the 1940s of chemo. We've just come out of World War. We're in the middle of World War II and still using mustards and realizing that you can use it for chemo. That's where we're at with immuno at the moment. So I just wanted to stress that point. I'm open-minded about stage 4 using vaccines there. We just need to understand the biology. I don't think adjuvant's going to be the best place either, necessarily. There might be a sweet spot in between. But one thing I can say is when we look at recurrence in the trial of V940 plus Pembro, the phase 2 randomized in melanoma, guess what? 90% of the neoantigens that were expressed at baseline and put into the vaccine were still there at recurrence. So there's still stuff we've got to learn.
Yeah. I've still got many, many questions, but we are a bit time limited. But one thing, and I feel sort of sad asking this question because I feel we've made, as you've said, Georgina, we've made so much progress, but we're still at the very infancy of our understanding of immunology and vaccines. But since the COVID-19 pandemic, we have seen a lot of an increase in vaccine hesitancy. So particularly, you know, to COVID-19 and even other infectious diseases, there are measles outbreaks in the US occurring at the moment. There are pockets in Australia as well. Do you feel that in your experience, this is to both you, Ken, and Georgina, do you think that cancer vaccines also cause a similar reaction in your patients when you mention them?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think if you've got cancer, it's a different situation. You know, you're targeting a very specific disease. And I think that, you know, the person wants to get cured. The person wants to have the best chance of survival. So I don't think there'll be any resistance. You know, whereas with COVID and with some of the other vaccines, particularly I think the COVID, the reason it created hesitancy is because a lot of people got vaccinated that probably didn't need to be vaccinated. And that's created a bit of a negative feeling because there's been a lot of, you know, subclinical toxicities that are emerging that people are concerned about, that maybe they feel, well, you know, why did I get my child vaccinated against this? Why was a young person vaccinated who may have died from the vaccine? That's a different type of situation. If you've got cancer, you want to be cured. And if you've got an idea about how to do that, people are going to be in favour of it. It's like when you do a clinical trial, Tom, you know, some patients say, well, look, I just want the standard treatment. But an awful lot of people are willingly to get involved in trials and even more so in translational research. I don't think I've had a single patient refuse to give a blood sample for translational research. I can't hardly remember anybody, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there's a, you know, if you're going to offer somebody something that might make the chance of them surviving longer better, they're going to get engaged and involved.
Yeah. Do you agree, Georgina? Do you see much hesitancy?
No, absolutely. In fact, I have the opposite. I heard about this thing. When can I get it? So yeah, I've had maybe one patient express concern about the mRNA vaccine trial, but the rest are absolutely want to get involved, want the treatments, want to do clinical trials. And Ken's right. I think when you're facing a significant diagnosis and an existential crisis, I think that flips things on the head when it's your existential crisis. It's not the world's.
Yeah.
It wasn't COVID for the world where some people will be okay. This was your true one and only major existential crisis. It changes everything. And I think in this world of untruths, and there is, I mean, you cannot believe anything on social media. That is a truth now.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we haven't understood that yet, but you seriously cannot believe anything unless it's come out of a peer-reviewed and you see it yourself. I think it is remarkable that we have that trust in the process of medicine and science at the heart of it. And I would hope that although the pendulum swung to not understanding how medicine and science works, the hypothesis testing, that science does not want to answer everything. We're just attempting to. We're just trying to understand, and that it brings up many more questions. But when people can understand that, it's incredible how they do actually have trust in that process. We are not saying we have the answers. We're just trying, and we're going to collect as much data and evidence as we can, and we might get it wrong, and then we'll switch and flex, but that is science.
Yeah.
So it's really important in this age where we've got a lot of complete untruths out there, and AI, beautifully, very effective, helpful in medicine and science, but because of the way it collects data, that cannot give you the truths. In fact, that can create a snowball effect about an untruth as well. So remembering that and seeing that our patients are saying yes and willingly, you know, participate in clinical trials is really, really encouraging and hopeful, particularly with what we're going through in the world right now.
Yeah. Assuming that your study, particularly, Georgina, because that I think is more at the forefront, you've completed recruitment, that the lung studies are still recruiting. So we're still a way away, and we're certainly watching the melanoma space in anticipation. So assuming it is a positive study, are we prepared to be able to, you know, perform such testing to develop vaccines, to roll out this sort of this technology?
Absolutely. One thing is results like this force innovation in terms of cutting timelines. It was interesting in the phase 3 V940 because I did the phase 2 as well, so I saw how slow it could be. It really got down to 3.5 weeks. So it was pretty spectacular. And if you then have to scale that up, I think humans have always been able to shine through and get things going in a very organized way. And certainly I know that the companies behind this, Moderna, are looking at that. We know that they've started building a factory in your very own Victoria, Tom, for infectious diseases mainly. But, you know, these are things people are thinking about and working hard on. Just before this podcast, I came off our immunotherapy platform testing that we do at MIA. It's our own platform. We put every patient's tumor through the platform. We present a multi-omics. We've now got that down to 4 weeks. We're now using that in clinical trials, and we want to get it down to 2 weeks. And that will be phenomenal, not just for melanoma, but for other cancers. And we're now doing clinical surveys. So we're asked to fill out a survey, what we'd give the patient before we see that platform result versus after. Everything's being innovated and moving very quickly now. I have no doubts we'll get there. It'll be expensive at first, but we'll find ways to make it happen.
Yeah.
No, just I agree with that. We and the multi-omics platforms, I think, are going to come thick and fast. Companies like Akoya are already trying to develop these for using multiplex immunohistochemistry. I know yours is a bit more advanced than that in terms of what it's doing. And we're developing pipelines here with Arutha Kulasinghe, who's a scientist here. You probably have heard of him, Georgina. And we're developing Python Prism pipelines for analyzing data as well and coming up with answers for sensitivity and resistance to immunotherapy, identifying new targets for therapy. So it's going to happen extremely quickly. And you can't, I don't know what you feel, but you can go into ChatGPT and ask ChatGPT a question and you get an answer really quickly. And it's not the right answer, obviously, the full answer, but it can be very good if you're trying to get something done quickly, asking a question to point you in a direction. So we're all kind of using AI now regularly, and that's just going to massively speed up the rate at which things happen. So it's a very exciting time in medicine in general. But just want to mention too, because we did say we'd talk about preventative vaccines a little bit. I think there's just some exciting work coming through with EGFR mutations, KRAS mutations, not just in lung cancer, but in other tumor types. And then there's the LungVax program that's just been funded with a big grant in the UK. You know, it's interesting, we may move back to where Ian Fraser was by giving vaccines against HPV to prevent, HPV-driven cancers. And we're seeing the benefits of that now in our population. And we may actually end up moving back to, you may even find pan-cancer vaccines, which is kind of an interesting concept, but why not, you know? They're all there to be thought about and the consequences of them too, of course.
Thank you, Ken and Georgina. And we could talk about this for a lot longer.
100%.
I certainly have enjoyed hearing the wisdom from both of you, even though it's a bit disappointing that we're still only in kindergarten. But I agree.
At least we're at school.
That's true.
At 66, it's great to feel like a kid.
But we do certainly have a long way to go. It's an exciting time. And I think the excitement in these studies and in these platforms are well-founded. I don't think we've seen anything this extraordinary before. And let's hope that it does actually translate and eventuate. And that you're right, Georgina, we have the capability of rolling this out quickly, because that, of course, will be the next frontier, I think, for us. So that brings us to the end of this episode, and thank you for listening to Toga's Conversations in Lung Cancer Research. If you enjoy the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. As I said, it has really been wonderful to have both Georgina and Ken joining me for this discussion.